Oh, yeah.
So thank you for turning up one more time. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints from what we've talked about so far? It was so clear, wasn't it? It was like,
yes.
You do? Oh, goody, goody. In that little piece of paper.
Yeah.
Which I didn't bring extra copies of, so. I have received so much teaching so many times from so many good teachers about how you sit down and prepare to meditate. And so eventually, over the years, I thought about maybe compiling some of the ideas that I thought were particularly good. And there's one copy. That's it. And then Lama Chodak Rinpoche, who I did a retreat with in Australia a couple of years ago, his language is just so sweet, and he, in a lot of the ways he talks about these things, I just really loved his language, so that really inspired me to plagiarize like that. So I formulated this after from all my beloved teachers, so somebody's trying to look over your shoulder there. So what's your question?
One of the lines here. When perception of subject-object duality.
In which paragraph are you?
It's in the 6th paragraph.
In the 6th paragraph, when perception of subject-object duality dissolves.
Which creates the sense of self fades. Mm-hmm. The desire from which that perception arises will still go on. So I was contemplating about that desire. And is that the desire to become? Is that...
Yeah.
At which when you die,
When this
body dissolves and one is in, and there is the bardo, that desire is still there.
Yeah, that's what is the wind in the bardo.
So that I just had the sense that it doesn't, like, when does it cease? Like, what do you? How do you make it stop?
Yeah, and that is like such a great question. You don't have it either, do you, Randy? But did you hear what she said? Did you all hear her?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, okay. Picking up my chalk and using the blackboard. Oh, Becky. You don't want your notebook right now.
Thank you.
We're recording this.
So, what the Buddha did to me is so inspiring, especially because whenever I see something impossible that somebody else does, actually carries it off. It always stops me in my tracks, and I go, how did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
What the Buddha did was very interesting. If you look at the actual story, he was quite happy. He was just your happy camper.
Mm-hmm.
He was living in a world very like North America today because he had nothing but material goods. He had a real good place to live. His air conditioning never failed. He had, instead of TV, he had all the best minds of the time. He used to love watching the stars and planets and all the astrologers and all the people that had ways of looking at them. He used to gather them around him. He had, you know, your basic harem. Well, I would change that a little bit. You know, maybe I'd change the sex of who was in my harem. What would you call it then? A hism.
A hism.
I would have a hism instead of her. And maybe at some point I would just get rid of them altogether because you know it. It's just so troublesome. But anyway, I wouldn't have to cook or do the laundry, so it wouldn't be quite so bad. And he was intelligent, and he was charming, and he was married to a woman that he loved. And they had a kid. And of course it was a son. One of the problems my mother had was that she had three daughters before she managed to get the son. But, you know, she recovered at that point, so everything was okay. But he had a son right off. Some other people do that. I haven't heard of this, but he did it right off. Or she did, or something. But when his wife and his son were sleeping one time, he went for a ride in the town. His father was very concerned that he might actually start getting interested in a spiritual life instead of continuing in the family tradition, which was he was the ruler of this small kingdom. And it's nice to have somebody pick up the, you know, family business of being the ruler. And he was the only son, so that's what he was going to do. He was going to, you know, carry on in his father's business. And so his father had decided, because he had received a prophecy when the kid was born, that if this kid actually, just be where the stars were when he was born, if this kid actually saw suffering, he would probably become spiritual. So he had made a rule that in his kingdom there wasn't allowed to be any old people in the kid's sight. Nobody was allowed to get a cold in his sight. They had to go on a holiday. And no sickness, no disease of any kind, and certainly no old age. So in his whole life, he kind of lived in this super little high school thing when he was in high school age. And, you know, everything was the right equivalent young, kind of like our commercials of today. You know, and the ads you see on the magazines when you go through checkout, you know, when you're really tired and the kids are screaming and, you know, and then there's somebody telling you how you should be, whatever. Kind of like that. That was his whole sense. That was normal for him. That was life. So he went out this one time, you know, and there was an old person. And he was like even older than me. Like old. Very old. Like that, you know? Old. And he had never seen anybody like that. He was like shocked. He said to his valet, his what?
Driver.
His driver. What was
driver.
Yeah. Who's that? What is that? What kind of animal is that? I had never seen. That's not a cat or a dog or a human. Who is that? What is it? Oh, well, that's an old person. What does that mean? Well, that's what's happening to all of us. Ah! He's in his 20s. He's never seen anything like this. And then they go a little further. And there's some leper, somebody, very sick. Young, very sick. Absolutely astounded. And then he sees a corpse. And everything that he thinks that you can do or make or believe in life is like gone like that. Because his whole life he's thought that you are your possessions and your position. He's thought that you are your identity. And like that, it's gone. Just gone. He goes home, and he looks at his wife, and he looks at his kid. They're sleeping. And he thinks, what have I got to give them? If there's old age, if there's sickness, if there's death, what have I actually got? What is there that is any validity? Mm. It all just looked very meaningless to him. But he had also seen a monk. What is that monk doing? Oh, well, he's trying to find a way to escape from the dissatisfactoriness of life. Well, he had no choice because he loved his family. So he left. Just up and left. In the process of his next 6 or 7 years, he is said to have discovered a way. And he summarized it the most succinctly by saying, there is dissatisfactoriness. There is this continuous desire, craving, craving, craving. But there is no one caught in it. That's the most succinct way he said it. When he talked about it a little more in detail, he talked about it by using the term ignorance. He said, it's dependent on ignorance, on what we ignore. Because we ignore this, we reach for that. We all know that's true. You can look back on your life and think, well, I wish I had seen this before I did that, or if only done. Can't you? Mm-hmm. And probably 2 weeks from now, you might look back on today and say that. But then he went even further. He started talking about ignorance itself. And he talked about ignorance as being 3 points that are totally tied to one another. Totally tied to one another. Where there is ignorance, there are three things linked in a dynamic flow, play. And he said those three things are craving or desire, false view. Does this sound vaguely familiar?
Yes, extremely vaguely familiar.
False view. Conceit. And they go round and round and round. When you see this represented, particularly in the Vajrayana, in the Tibetan teaching, what you see is a three-sided pyramid. That's really badly drawn, but I'm drawing upside down. Which is called the Dharmakara. It's a three-sided pyramid. And the three-sided pyramid, each of the sense doors in the Vajrayana teaching, in the Tibetan teaching, mostly Tibetan, it's also in other schools, but mostly Tibetan, so I'll say Tibetan because that's easier. A lot of you might not know the word Vajrayana. In the Tibetan teaching, you have these red hot tomato dakinis that represent each one of the five senses. So the one for the eyes is carrying a mirror, the one for the ears is carrying a lute, you know. And they're each carrying something that suits for the five senses. Because the five senses are considered to be this being state of a continuous vibration that's always willing to dance and be delicious. The one for the mind is the Dharmakara, is carrying the Dharmakara. So the six senses, the mind is always carrying this. And it has the 3 points of craving, false view, and conceit. And it is also called, Sultram Alioni calls it the cervix of all creation, but other teachers call it the womb of all creation. This is the womb of all manifestation. Everything that is born comes through. There is this quality of energy of consciousness called ayatana consciousness that is just this dull, undifferentiated desire. But it's not differentiated yet. Then the next level of consciousness is the beginning of separateness out, of moving out. It is the beginning of ignorance. Because in order to separate, you have to ignore. Now, you've heard this from me so many times, haven't you? Do you want to hear it again, or is that good enough? Do you want to hear it again? Shall I do my now thing? Shall I do? Yeah, do that? Okay. So the best way I know of showing you what ignorance is that you have to do this physical exercise, and I understand it's going to cause some of you real strain because you've probably just eaten and stuff, but bear with me, and if you break out into a sweat, Twig will bring towels later. But what you are going to do is you're going to sit there kind of just fairly relaxed, right? Like this, right? And when I say now, you're going to go. Or if you want to, you can go. Is that good?
Yes.
You can put your hair behind your ears if it's like mine. And so, you know, if I say now, you're going to go. Or you're going to go. Right?
Yes.
Turn your head really fast and turn it back. Then I'm going to ask you a question. And you're all going to answer at the same time. If you don't answer, I'll yell at you. So answer whatever comes into your mind, even if it's wrong. Okay? And then I'm going to say now again. And you're going to turn your head real fast and I'm turn it back. And then I'm going to ask you a question again. And you all answer at the same time. Now. What'd you see? 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 Now. Heather? Now. What'd you see? Turn your head faster. Now. What'd you see? Turn your head faster. Now. What'd you see? Turn it faster. Turn it faster. Turn it back. You won't get the exercise if you don't. Now. What'd you see? Now. What'd you see? Now. What'd you see? Now. What'd you see? Do you always see the same thing?
No.
No.
Sometimes, yes.
But do you always see the same thing?
No.
Why not?
You can't.
Why not?
Hold it all. It's too much.
Well, you want to see more.
But, I mean, you're just sitting here. There's no reason for you to see one thing more than another. You do tend to see one thing because it's easier to see the blinds if you're sitting here. But there is also, you find every once in a while your mind gives you a different feed,
yes.
doesn't it, of what
yes.
you saw.
Yeah.
Why does it do that?
Perception is always changing.
What? That's called ignorance. Because you've already seen that, so you're going to ignore it and pick something else.
Yeah.
Ignorance is a power. It is what allows us to differentiate. It's brilliant. Without it, you wouldn't know where your car was. You wouldn't be able to differentiate space and time. So that's why sometimes, quite often you see the same thing, but every once in a while you don't.
Mm-hmm.
How come you're not telling yourself what you want to see? You know, it's interesting. It's because we have this power to always look for something new. Oh, I saw that already, so I'll ignore that. I'll look for something new. And it's happening all the time. We're always ignoring. It's when we get stuck in a pattern of ignoring because we're attached to something or afraid of something and we don't know that we're ignoring, that it creates problems. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
So when the Buddha is talking about ignorance as a canker, what he called a canker, as something that causes you suffering, he's not talking about the ignorance that is inherent in being a conscious existence. So long as you are conscious in any form of a body, amoeba, that ignorance is operating. Is that clear? And when that ignorance is operating, there is always going to be, oh, I already saw that, oh, I'm going to look for this. Oh, I really like looking at that, I'm going to look at it again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what color was that picture? I'm going to look at it again. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
The likes and dislikes subtly play all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Subtly, all the time. Subtle, subtle, subtle. They're always playing. So this is called the power of ignorance. But for most of the time, for most of us, we don't see the patterns of always ignoring something until we have the third relationship, only the name has changed to protect the innocent, with a friend or a job or, you know, a lover or, you know, a child or whatever. Whatever. When we start noticing the pattern, then you start, you know, and you can't find any reason why it was their fault, then maybe you start looking at yourself. And then maybe you start discovering some of your ignorances, and you start discovering the passion, the craving that is looking for satisfaction by looking for something that might satisfy it, or looking for another way to have the same relationship, but this time not have it end that way, or looking for... Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So there is the craving, and with the craving, basically, when there is consciousness giving... When the craving is now working within the realm of ignorance, it's actually going to create a life, an energy. There are the elements mixed in there, and they're going to come out, and there's going to be some manifesting. Then there is some kind of sense of an object. And either like or dislike will create an I, the conceit. Mm. And they're so subtle, and they're so fast. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that will create the circumstance for the arising of a mind body, of a being.
Mm-hmm.
When you have, from the Buddhist point of view, when you have the ability to turn around and see them operating, and you look directly at the craving, when you look directly and you just see the craving, basically what you're seeing is, when this arises, this results. When this arises, this results. When this arises, this results. You're seeing the paticca-samuppada, the law of interdependent arising. Which is then called, and you're seeing that, which is then called craving is transformed into clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Then when the view arises of want, that picture, then you also have the ability to see and know that that sense of that picture is based more on what I'm looking for than on what that picture really is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is called emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
And when there is clarity and there is emptiness, then the sense of whoever is arising as conceit becomes non-dual wisdom. So that's how it stops.
Thank you.
So all of us will tend to have a talent for one of these three a little more than the others. But especially these two.
Mm.
And some people, you know, they're very good at doing the emptiness. Non-self, the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
But the sense of the clarity, it's sort of like being in an ocean of confusion in a certain way. You understand, the important thing in Buddhism is the balance.
Mm-hmm.
So all meditations, basically, can be divided into three types. Calm abiding,
mm-hmm.
insight,
mm-hmm.
and non-dual. So, this would be calm abiding. This would be insight. And the result is non-dual. So as you know, in the Buddhist tradition, they say that the experience of liberation from dissatisfactoriness is the result of actions. The experience of suffering is the result of actions. So when you're doing these actions, you're giving birth to the wheel, a subject who is caught in this dissatisfactoriness. When you're doing these, the actions that bring the result of not being caught by the suffering, you give birth to the experience of freedom from suffering.
In that context, what is bodhicitta?
Bodhicitta, there are two levels of bodhicitta. And of course, being a Buddhist thing, the first level also has two levels. How many ways can we divide it? So, yes, let me see. You want it? Add something to her question, or should I finish her question first? And then, is that okay? Okay, I'll be right with you. Don't go anywhere. So bodhicitta is essentially the mind of opening, the mind of liberation, the mind of being liberated from duality, the open mind, liberated from being caught in duality. That's what bodhicitta means. And the two kinds of it are one is called the wishing bodhicitta, or relative bodhicitta sometimes. Relative bodhicitta. And the first kind of wishing bodhicitta is when you say, oh, I wish I could do something for my kid so he wasn't suffering so much. Or, I wish I could help my neighbors so they weren't suffering so much. I wish my dog wasn't so sick. You understand?
Yeah.
And the second kind of wishing bodhicitta is like, I'm going to find something. There's got to be a way. The first one is it sitting there and wishing it, but still being contained within, you know, but is it safe? Can I do? There's still the sense of I is stronger than the desire. So the focus is still, I hope something comes into me to help. But the second one is, no, I want to find out if there's something I can. So it sort of like goes beyond, you know, jealousy, pride, all the five poisons. The second one, it has a strength to it. Absolute bodhicitta is the experience when there is a... I'm trying to figure out how complicated to... make this answer. It's very simple in one way. In another way, when there is truly an experience of consciousness without duality, which you get when you experience jhana, and quite a few people in this room have had experience a state of absorption in meditation, and for some people in their work with music or whatever, they experience it, such a total absorption that for a moment they're not sure what time it is or anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that level of absorption is called jhana in Buddhism. That you can practice meditations that deepen and deepen and deepen and deepen that until there is a point where you actually have no memory of what happens, because there is neither subject nor object in the state of absorption. It's so total. And the blissfulness after that is quite beautiful. So when you come out of that jhana, one of the dangers with practicing jhana, which is why a lot of the people who teach insight practice don't like jhana, is that it feels so beautiful that you actually think that that's it. Mm-hmm. And it is. You know, it transcends anything you've had before, so it's certainly transcendent. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, from your point of view, it's transcendent. Mm-hmm. The thing about it that is the difficulty is how completely, totally there is an understanding of no self when you come out of one of the higher jhanas. Mm-hmm. There is this very profound understanding of just the joyousness of consciousness without duality. Mm-hmm. Which can be a trap, yes, for some people. Mm-hmm. If you have good Dharma friends, that will help a lot, because they'll break out in hysterical laughter when you tell them that. And point to your dishes that are still in the sink, or whatever. You know? It's very useful to have good friends. Or you have a good teacher like Ayakema, or you've read her book, Who is the Self, where she talks specifically about how to work with meditation if you work with both jhana and insight. Mm-hmm. And her book, Who is the Self, is one of the most beautiful books I have ever seen, giving a full exposition of how to work with insight and jhana. Just lovely book. So if you have the ability to go into that state where there is no sense of duality, no subject-object duality, and then you come out of that and you have the clarity of knowing that what you have seen is the mind in its natural state, but like they say in all the classical texts, in jhana, the glass of water, the dirty, sandy stuff, the silt has settled to the bottom, and so just for a moment you see the nature of the true mind. But in life it will get shaken up again. Mm-hmm. And that what you have is you have an experience that actually, if you use it well, will increase your faith in the no-self, in the no-inherent identity. Mm-hmm. Is that good? So then at that state, to particularly help you move beyond subtle clinging, to bring in the idea of compassion, to think that that is every being's mind, and that your desire to experience that is so that all beings, you can reflect that to all beings. Because now there isn't the same attachment to subject-object. Mm-hmm. But there is the danger of just kind of resting there. Mm-hmm. So that's when you would bring in the Bodhi... Usually they start in the Vajrayana, the Bodhisattva vow, before you even have a jhana. But that is where it's the most important. If you've already developed the habit of it before that, that helps a lot. But that's what you're guarding against with that. When you experience that state of total absorption into the clear mind, natural mind, that then you come out of that, and even if there isn't a teacher there, you have already seeded that habitual idea of doing this not only for yourself but for the sake of all beings, so that the mind then actually moves beyond that to clarity and emptiness. Mm-hmm. Not just the emptiness. Mm-hmm. Not just the no inherent self. Mm-hmm. Because when you have, thus have I heard, now I'm not going to talk from my experience, when you have the full experience of freedom from dissatisfactoriness, there is also great compassion. So bodhicitta, absolute bodhicitta, is talking about that state. Mm-hmm. Attainment and compassion. Mm-hmm. That was a bit long-winded. Was that okay?
That's good.
Yeah.
That's
interesting.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Just as a clarification, Trudy's question was talking about going into the bardo and having... sort of taking those things with you. Are you taking that triad with you as you go into the bardo? Like, is it like those are the conditions?
You are inside that triad all the time. Whatever you are, you are continuously being born and dissolving within that triad. Let me borrow Becky's notebook again. Put it to you this way. When you do some of the arising yogas, anybody not know what arising yogas are? Okay. This would be a practice of arising yoga. For example, you know, some days you wake up and you feel kind of grumpy. Does that ever happen to you on occasion? Once in a while. So, and that day you wake up and then you decide, or something in you decides that you're going to create the deity energy of grumpiness and perform it like a deity. And then something will change your mind, and you'll be happier. A cup of coffee, maybe. Who knows? It could be anything. And now you're performing the deity yoga of, White Tara. Benevolent, remembering all the good things that have ever supported me. Let me help you with anything, nothing. Right? So it's basically, there is a saying that I quote ad nauseum to these people here, and they're so kind to listen to me. I say, consciousness which has no legs rides winds which have no eyes. So the winds of the energies which have no eyes are what consciousness rides on in order to manifest. So sometimes the winds are blowing grumpy, sometimes the winds are blowing, right? So when you're doing the work in the Tibetan tradition, what you're doing is you're practicing manifesting your life energy along these different radiant forms, rather than just having them arise as grumpy or fearful or over the top happy, or, and so that you actually learn that you are the one who rides the winds, or you are the one who's on Lake Ontario and the winds are blowing, but you're going to tack and go the way you want to, regardless of how the winds are blowing. Now that is basically the theory that is called arising yoga, where you practice deities, radiant energy, okay? So, some arising yogas that you do in the Tibetan tradition, at some point you imagine everything dissolves by focusing on shunyata or emptiness. You see everything dissolving into emptiness because you know that your body is mostly space. I already talked about the inner tube, right?
Yes.
That from here to here you're just a tube. Basically, we're all just inner tubes. And there's little holes everywhere. Your blood is a bunch of little vans full of nothing, taking oxygen around, carbon dioxide. Your whole body, you know, is mostly water, but it isn't really. It's mostly space, then mostly water. So we're all basically, essentially, mostly nothing, with a few little things arranged around it. Excellent sculpture. And so when you're doing one of these arising yogas that I'm about to talk about, what you're doing is you start by letting yourself recall the emptiness rather than identifying with whatever energy is present at the moment. Recall the emptiness, and then out of that emptiness you make some kind of you've made some kind of aspiration before. I'd be doing Chenrezig, I'm doing this practice so that I may come to the understanding that compassion is not separate from the activity that stirs the depth of the universe. That all activity is actually compassion stirring. So then you made that aspiration, then you do the hollow body, or you look at the emptiness of your being. And then out of that arises an energy. So when you're doing some of the highest yoga tantras that have to do, or the highest yoga tantras or tantras that have to do with arising yogas that have to do with not just right now am I going to recreate my energy, but I would like to have started from a slightly better place this lifetime, so I'm going to imagine myself now being born and being arising with all possible potentiality. Needy. So what you imagine arising out of the emptiness is a lotus. Which is coming out of the mud, moves through the streamy, funky water, comes a couple of feet above the water, and then manifests in a totally other world. So it's like transcending three different realms, see? The mud, the muddy water, and then above into a whole different realm. So the seed that is going to flower into a totally different experience. And on the lotus, sometimes there's no lotus, sometimes it's just the Dharmakara. A huge Dharmakara, big as the universe. And it's usually white on the outside and pink on the inside, pinky, reddy color on the inside. And inside it is yum air. Rum, fire. Bum, water. Lum, earth. And then there can be various things on top of that. Often if you're going to do some great rebirth, like this time you're going to be reborn as a Buddha, about to become a Buddha this lifetime, you would do an eight-spoked wheel with a Hri on it. Mm-hmm. But usually you do some variation of Hri. Some variation of Hri. Sometimes you do a broom because a new broom sweeps clean, you all know that. So sometimes you do a broom, but mostly a Hri. And a Hri sound means energy rising. It's a seed syllable, doesn't have any meaning, but it has a power, an energy, like oh does, or like that. How to translate oh or in another language would be a little bit difficult. But the feeling of them is not difficult to translate at all. So the same with the seed syllables. So on top of that would be some seed syllable, let's say it's a Hri. And then above it is Om Ah Om with a Ho below it and a Ho upside down. You can tell that's upside down because you can see that this H is upside down and that H is right side up, right? And that O is upside down and this O is right side up. You can see that, can't you? Ho and Ho. So this one's upside down. You can see that quite clearly. Do you want me to put a little arrow there so you remember? And that one's right side up. Perfectly clear now, isn't it? This is the rebirth-bringing karma. This is the seeds, the all the vows, all the seeds of karma looking for a place to happen that blow when a life is over. And they don't all blow together. You don't get one little neat bundle. But then you don't get one little neat bundle in one day. You know that there are days where you know that something happened that has totally changed your life, don't you? Mm. You've all had that experience, haven't you?
Yes.
Where from that time on, you're totally a different person. So there isn't a self that is unchanging, fixed forever and ever. And when you go through a major experience, like, say, example, death, there could be a few changes. So it's you, but it's not you. They call it the mental continuum. That's what they call it. Although you're pretty mindless in a certain way, it's still called the mental continuum because it's some continuum of some type, some level of consciousness. First there is the total dissolution, and then there is the re-arising of what they call the mental continuum. This is interesting to you, is it?
Yes.
Sure hate like heaven to bore ya. So, when you're doing this, and this arising, when you're doing this arising, when you're manifesting it, this is the classical Tibetan way of practicing rebirth. Because you know that when you're doing an ordinary arising yoga, at the end you always have the figure dissolve and you dissolve. And it's basically practicing death. But in these meditations, not only do you practice death, then rebirth, and then death. In these meditations, the ones that have this kind of thing in it. Because what you have here is basically consciously recreating a life. That's what you're doing. You are practicing being a tulku. Neat, huh? So here are the elements, which are the winds, ready to be made into a container. Here is the hri, which is the sort of the channel, the funnel that's going to be used for the rebirth linking karma to pour through into the bottle. And this is the Dharmakara, based on clarity, emptiness, and conceit, or craving, false view. And clarity, emptiness, and non-dual wisdom, or craving, false view, and conceit. Or, for most of us, a little of both. A little mix. So from a classical Buddhist point of view, this experience is happening all the time, but in such a small little way and so quick. And we mostly don't see the gap in our consciousness anyway, do we? We don't watch our mind making a movie and see ourselves creating the meaning from frame to frame, so I'm looking at this person in the car. Have you ever seen What the Bleep?
Yes. Yes.
Seen that movie? Oh, you gotta see it. You can rent it. Do you have a DVD player? Excellent. You gotta rent it. It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's brilliant?
Yes.
Yes. Well,
I'll run out and get it. So
clap. You love it.
Oh, yeah.
Is it animated or
No, it's acted with portions of animation. Like it's a love story, eh?
Oh.
Yeah, it's a love story about this woman who keeps slipping in and out of the cracks of reality because she has this all the evidence about, you know, past problems with men, and she has to go cover a wedding. And she knows that the groom is actually unfit. She's a reporter, a photographer. She knows that the groom is actually unfaithful. She's covering this wedding.
This is not her wedding.
No, she has to go photograph it. Meanwhile, there's another affair going on, but the one that I'm going to describe to you, because it's like not that important to the plot. In a way. And she's at this wedding, and she's like absolutely, she's pissed off because she doesn't want to cover the wedding. Mm-hmm. And she's really pissed off about weddings. And she knows that she just saw the groom slip into the other room with the bridesmaid. And the bride's over there.
You're not going to give away the plot.
No, I'm just telling you a little side story.
Okay.
And so in that point, when she knows that, then she sees the groom come out of a room, and then it switches to animation. It shows all of the cells of her body going into aggression hormones.
Yes.
And then suddenly she sees the groom is with the bride, and who she thought was with the bridesmaid is some other guy. And then she goes into, oh, everything is lovely. And then all the hormones, and she goes to animation. And it keeps flipping between the outer story and the inner story.
Yeah.
It doesn't even talk about projection. It just shows you how the body flips back and forth.
Great.
It is brilliantly done, you know? I mean, I have lots of complaints about it, but none that matter. You know, they're all just like going, yeah, 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 yeah. But, I mean, there are some parts of that movie that are just, it's just so nice to see an intelligent movie.
Yes.
Did you find it intelligent? I mean, there's lots of holes, you know, scientific holes and stuff.
But intelligent enough.
No, but
it's very superficial. It is, in scientific way, it is populistic.
Yeah, but I mean, it's intelligent. Yeah, it's popular. Yeah, I'm saying I can certainly pick holes in it too, but overall, what a relief to see a movie like that rather than
it is.
Yeah, exactly. Then you go and you think, wow, geez. And when you're walking across the street, you're watching your body in a different way. Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Oh. And you watch people leave it. They do that. You know, see, this is really, I'm talking about craving false unity.
What's the name of it again?
What is it? What the Bleed?
What do you know?
Do we know?
Do we know?
Do we know? I think
I've heard of it.
That's the name. You can check it on the web by just Googling What the Bleep. Get all kinds of information about it.
It has trailers there. I have children in the web, so you can see the trailers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So is that enough about this?
That's great.
I'm not sure if I exactly answered your question. Was that okay?
Yeah.
We have a photo copy.
Yes, because I can't see it.
Yeah, I can.
Is it anywhere in the books? Can we read about that?
So I can photocopy that if you'd like it.
I don't think anybody. You want to find out?
Well, we couldn't see it from here.
Thank you. It's Becky's. It belongs to Becky. You have to ask Becky. That's Becky's piece of paper. She will make photocopies.
Thank you.
No problem.
What is this quote you have about the wings?
Isn't that beautiful? Consciousness, which has no legs, rides winds, which have no eyes.
Amazing.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's what Terry was quoting last summer.
Oh, was he? Yeah. It's so beautiful.
Can you talk a little bit about the notion of identity? I mean, you already have in this, I guess identity falls into conceit. Grasp after.
Conceit is self-referencing. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. Self-reference. That's all it is. It's not, I am conceited because I'm grasping after you. It is like when there is self.
Identification.
Yeah. So there are, did you want me to talk about conceit? What do you want me to talk about?
You don't have to go anywhere with it, really.
The mistake people make when they hear about ego is that you can do anything about it, rather than why don't you explore and see what it is. And that can be a really dangerous mistake, because if you actually explore and try to see what yourself is, it gets very interesting. You notice in a review through the day of, you know, different selves that existed that day, how variable they all are. And that there are times when you can't really remember yourself, and there are always times when you're having a good time. Sometimes other times too, but certainly when you're having a good time, you don't have any particular sense of self. There is just an openness. When you're in love, when you're happy, there's just an openness. There's not particularly a sense of self. It's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When you're busy, when you're trying to get too much done, when you're worried, you know? Pretty good sense of self there. When I was going back for my books, oh my God, I hope Karen hasn't, oh, she's probably parked in the back. Oh, I don't know how to get to the back. So, of course, I took two wrong turns. Instead of just like, oh, well, I hope I catch her, I'll just drive back and see. I would have driven right there, you know? So the real problem, I think, that a lot of people have when they want to start meditating or something is that they're supposed to make themselves into something. Mm. Or that they should be themselves in a certain way. It's like trying to be other than what is present. And that creates all kinds of difficulties. That can create major stresses in the being. And that's why meditation often gets a bad name.
Well, it's dealing with various levels of, well, as you pointed out, delusion, but the fear states that come up when the notion of there being no self. It's inconceivable for someone, for most people who have not entered into the...
For all of us.
For the breath, yes, it has
for
various
all of
levels.
Us. It's the most terrifying thing. And so one of the things that you have to the self has to do is learn to be at least interested in fear. And you need the self to do that. But like, you know, trying to meditate by getting rid of the self, I don't think so. I don't think that's possible. But when the meditation is going well, then the self-opening will happen to the point where there is experience beyond self-having. That's the point. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
I don't know how this is possibly going on. When you compare the attitude of the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita, and developing through one's practice the opening of the heart occurs, and when you compare that, for instance, to say a Christian path of putting one's faith in, you know, the I thou, the Martin Buber notion of surrendering, and there's such irony in and complexity in the comparative.
Absolutely.
Is there not?
Oh God, yeah.
Because one could say they ultimately deliver, you know, to they come into a knowing on similar trajectories, but not so similar.
Yeah, in one way that's true. In one way that's really true. I think because when you're talking about what you were calling the Christian, I would probably, because I've met it in other religions too, and I'm sure you have too, but I would call that the devotional path.
Yes, yes, yes.
And really, in Buddhism, the devotional path is highly used in the Theravadin, in the Vajrayana, and the Mahayana. But not so much in the Theravadin path, although you are supposed to develop a devotion toward your preceptor and toward the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Mm. So there is, it's allowable, but it's not the big focus. Mm-hmm. But when you look at Buddhism, basically there are two powers, two winds, two emotions that will really aid in daily transcendence of being caught in duality. One of them is compassion and the other is devotion. So, being Buddhism, of course, it gets much more intellectual about them. But there are a lot of Buddhists who just approach the whole question of guru or of preceptor. I mean, Achan's Cha students, a lot of his students in Thailand were like totally, totally practicing guru yoga.
Who was that?
Achan Cha. Mm. You know, Jack Kornfield's teacher, mm-hmm. And that, and remember I went there after we were in Japan. Mm-hmm. Heather and I were in Japan together. That was pretty nice.
What part of Japan?
We were mostly in Kyoto. Yeah. Heather was there longer than me. She got there earlier. And she was studying at Daitokuji. With Kubori-sa.
Kubori-sensei. And you were up the hill.
And Taiji. With Uchiyama-san. But I used to go to Kubori-san every once in a while because the way he chanted the Heart Sutra was like a blues singer, wasn't it? And I liked that.
That's yeah. True. The way he played that fish.
Oh man, he was somebody. Mm-hmm. And Uchiyama-san was pretty wonderful. I remember one time I was supposed to come and see him, and I came and knocked on the sliding door, you know, and my shoes off, I'm kneeling and I'm knocked. And he said, come, and I opened the door, and he looked at me and said, where's Jiva? That was my name then. Where's Jiva? So the whole thing about similarities and differences, isn't it a difficult question? I don't know, because at some point it seemed to me that the Buddhist path was more likely to keep me honest. Mm-hmm. But when I was younger, I was Christian. You know, my first teacher was a Christian. When I was 14, I met my first teacher, and he was a Christian minister. And I was, like, totally involved. And the whole sense of the devotional path is very compelling to me. That there is always that other part of me that loves the beauty of how forms fit together and how the detail works, you know. Mm-hmm. need, you know. So, I'm sure that everybody has as many ideas as they could have on whether one is a right path or one is a wrong path, but I think for each of us, something calls us in our hearts in a way that we have to be very honest with ourselves about. And actually all of my teachers from day one have given me something so valuable that I wouldn't want to have lost and not had any of them. So I don't think that I could, I am not somebody who could talk about just being on one path. Or that this path works and that one doesn't, because that's not my experience. I'm very North American Buddhist, meaning a hodgepodge.
There's a very Buddhist prayer in Christianity. If you know prayer of St. Francis of Assisi?
Yes. It's so beautiful.
It is. This is absolutely
it's
the
so
same.
Beautiful.
Like, do you know it?
You know it?
I don't remember it by heart.
I
but
don't
you
either.
Know, just Google somewhere for St. Francis, Francis of Assisi, and it's basically it's the same idea. You know, God help me, help others. Where
that's
there's
it.
Suffering,
let there
let,
be,
let be joy.
Where
is where there's pain, you know, cure it.
It's in the book of poetry that I didn't bring tonight has St. Francis, St. Teresa of Avila, and you know, St. John of the Cross, and some of my favorite mystical poets in it. And it isn't any one religion. It is the song of the heart of compassion, and that is so beautiful. I totally agree. And it's an interesting question, too, because, again, we're getting into the same thing. Just like in Buddhism, like, you find a lot of teachers who are very careful about blissful experiences because they're so addictive. Mm-hmm. So also you can find that devotional experiences are very addictive. Mm-hmm. And then one little moment of disbelief or doubt and the being crashes, right? I know many people who have put all of their faith in a teacher. Mm. And then the teacher somehow, something happens, he teaches something that this, I am not the one you should have faith in, or something. And something lets go in them, and they go into hell. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I mean literally hell. And to actually keep a dialogue with people when they're in that state and try to say to them without sounding like some supercilious bitch, well, now you know what didn't work, you know, with your whole heart because you love them, want to say to them, well, now you know what, that didn't work. Don't believe it's you that's crashed. It was an ideal that didn't work. Because the sense of collapse about what I thought it was and what it wasn't mm-hmm. can feel so much like an identity to someone who's in that. That's hell. Mm-hmm. When that crashes, that's hell. So a lot of people in the West, you know, we have a lot of doubt about devotion. Don't we?
Yes.
We don't just exactly want to just trust it.
No.
But a lot of us who most early are doubtful about it are the ones who are most ready to fall into it. Mm-hmm. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. When you look at the Buddhist tradition, they have these things called the five moral... faculties, which I think I've taught only the last two times I came here.
You did the stupa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Last two times I particularly focused on the five right. moral faculties.
Yes, you did.
So now you can tell me what they are. One is mindfulness, awareness, mindfulness, and it's sort of the balance point. And then you got two that balance each other. One of those is concentration, and the other one is interest.
Right attitude?
Interest.
Interest.
Interest. Mm-hmm. Concentration means you get one pointed, but your energy can disappear, right?
Mm-hmm.
So interest means your energy is coming up because you're keeping an awareness around you. Sometimes it's translated as energy. But it's like hard to really say what Moore is talking about. The other two are devotion, which is balanced by intelligence.
Mm.
Because concentration without energy interest just goes into this dull state of bliss. Energy interest without the ability to hold the mind at one point just gets overwhelmed with scattered phenomena. True?
Yeah.
Has no power
yeah.
in the storm. Devotion
mm-hmm.
without intelligence
yeah.
is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Intelligence without devotion, it just sits around and talks about what might be possible.
Yeah.
Has no poof. It's a good word. Poof. So awareness is the balance point and the five moral faculties, because you're learning how to take those two, when there's concentration, how to then at a certain point bring interest and energy into it, bring in, you know, come in, back into the world and bring in energy interest of exploring, or, you know, use that one-pointedness and with exploration, investigation, and devotion with intelligence, and intelligence with devotion.
Yes.
When you develop them, then when you play with them a little while, then they're not called the five moral faculties anymore, they're called the five moral powers. So when they're the five moral powers, now you don't even have to think about it. When there's awareness and you bring up concentration, the interest is always there. Because you have taught yourself to hold them together. It's like riding a bicycle. You don't lean too much only to one side. You've got to keep it right, nicely balanced.
Can you talk a little bit about breath?
The breath in, with the five moral faculties, it may or may not be an issue. You may or may not be focusing on that. It usually, sometimes it stops, sometimes it doesn't. But you know that from jhana and your meditation experiences, that sometimes the breath will stop for, you know, quite a long period of time. And sometimes it's there, but very subtle. And sometimes it's, but there's, so, my experience is that you can't always tell, but is that what you meant by what patterns of breath there are?
I guess, no, I was just wanting you to, well, that was a good elaboration, more specifically, I think when someone is developing these moral faculties, the breath is often a tool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I've been talking about the five moral faculties and the five moral powers here, I've been talking about it in terms of the 37 requisites of enlightenment, which starts with the four foundations of mindfulness. It starts with meditation on the breath. So that's the first four, and so I've talked about this to these people ad nauseum, so they'd probably throw me out if I took this as yet another excuse to go on my favorite hobby horse. But anytime you want to talk about the 37 requisites, I'll be very happy. You must have a tape on that.
We might.
I'm sure.
Very good note.
Everywhere I go. Boise, Yukon. Everywhere I go, they've got a tape on me talking about the 37 requisites. Did you know it's the design for the stupa, one of the main designs for a stupa? Well, I'll be. Stop me now.
We didn't hear her talking about it.
I do recall a doctorate that was done, and you showed me
Blaming. Yeah, I do have a certain passion for this subject. It's better not to encourage me. So, we have 7 minutes left. How are you doing? Some of you look pretty tired.
I have to get up early for tennis.
Do you? What time do you get up?
Tennis. Well, maybe it's not that early for you, but I mean, when you're at least sleeping until 11, it's early. I have to get up at 10 around 8 o'clock.
Can they have tennis a little later?
Yeah, but when you stay up until 1 o'clock
hot.
In the morning, it's late.
It is so. It is so. Unless you stay up all night.
Mm, that's right.
That's a possibility. You have to drink coffee though to do that, probably. You know.
Well,
Pepsi
yeah.
that has caffeine in it. My sentiments, exactly. So you'd like me to wind this up now, then?
No.
Oh.
It's fun.
Okay.
It's fun.
Good. Okay, I was actually going to try to talk a little bit about a sadhana today. So what I would like to do is say, if you look at a sadhana, the structure of it is very interesting. A sadhana is a written text. It comes from the word sadha, which means faith. Faith, F-A-I-T-H. But in the Buddhist translation of faith has a lot to do with a sense of confidence. That's very nice to know. It means that there is a sense of faith inside and outside equally, not that it's I should forget how I feel and have faith in that. There is a sense of faith within your own being and the faith of stepping ahead, both. So the word is sadha, and the term for a practice that you do for an arising yoga is called sadhana. So it's like a faith developer, you know, the way to manifest faith. The way to manifest confidence in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is to take one of these texts and practice it every day for 3 months and then see whether your friends think anything is different. And it's very interesting to do that. But like, just do that. Practice it every day for 3 months. And then ask your friends, do you think anything is different about me in the last little while? And don't cue them. You know, don't set them up, just see what they say.
Oh, you may not want to hear that.
Huh?
You may not want to hear the answer then.
Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you?
All the things that they will tell you that changed about you.
But maybe then you'll know, okay, I'm putting that away. I mean, of course you wouldn't want to know. Oh, not that one. Maybe you want to do a different one. Maybe you're doing some fierce one, you know, one with blood dripping from them everywhere. Yeah, ever since last while, you walk in the room and the way you eye knives really makes me feel creepy. Yeah, you got a point there, actually.
You have to have to have a lot of faith inside of you, I guess, to come up with this question.
Yeah. And I thought maybe it would be interesting for you to have me break down a sadhana.
Oh, yes.
So I was thinking I might do that. I was wondering whether you wanted to do like a Tara or a Chenmezi or what?
White Tara would be lovely. We have a sadhana that we're...
So maybe I can look at it overnight. Can you lend it to me? Are you going to use it tomorrow?
Or? Yeah, if people are going to talk to you, I can print it out while... right after class.
Okay. And I'll just refresh myself with it.
Thank you.
And I thought that might be interesting for you if we just actually go through the sadhana and I start talking about it more in terms of doing the dishes and stuff like that, like in your daily life, what you're working with and why you would do it, and what you would look for. Because I know a lot of people, they do these practices and they don't really notice that they've changed with it. So I think sometimes it's nice to look at what actually the practice is suggesting to your psyche and how you might be reacting to that. Is that good?
Yes.
And I promise to bring the poetry if Karen will bring it.
Oh, yes. I'll go get it now.
Fine.
Bring it down. Or bring it
You want to bring these two books?
Yeah, I know. I remember.
You want to bring them to Alberta's?
I'll go get them and bring them right after class. You know.
Yeah, don't rush. But if you want to drop them off in Alberta's, don't rush. Just go now. No, but
I might read them.
So, that's good for tonight then?
That's wonderful.
I really appreciate the fact that you talked to me and asked me questions and stuff. That's really wonderful for me. That's very nice to actually have some kind of dialogue going. Because if somehow or other, when I come for such a short time...
Such a short time.
Because whoever it was invited me didn't get it together in time before. I didn't have any time left. I know.
What was that, Karen?
It was Beth's fault.
Of course.
Samaya.
Samaya
Tara. Yeah, the vow keeper. Keeping somebody else's vow. That's what it was.
This is your booked up a year and a half in advance.
A year.
But
yeah.
You're taking bookings up until October, you said.
I said this year I am going to be taking requests to come.
Right.
Until October.
All right.
Because I'm not going to figure out my schedule. So I already have a whole bunch. Mm-hmm. And people are telling me how long they would like me to come. Mm-hmm. And more or less when. Because I'm doing a 6-month retreat.
Yeah.
And then I'm not sure whether I'm going to travel or not next year. And I'm not going to decide until October. So if you're interested in putting up with such an iffy, you know, wishy-washy kind of commitment, that's my commitment.
Put our notice in.
Yeah, if you want me to come next year, I would suggest you let me know by October when and for how long. Because I'm not sure how much I will travel next year. Mm-hmm. I've been way too busy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm just letting you know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But I'm not leaving here until Sunday, so we can talk about it some other time. So whatever else you feel, you also feel this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts. And it spreads through your body. It goes down your arms and your legs, up your hair. It even goes down the hair tips. Tickles your back. Fills this whole room. Fills the house. Moves into space, moves into the ground. Fills all of Ontario, Quebec. Great Lakes. whole earth goes into space. Anyone you want to pray for is washed by that light. So that whatever there is of suffering due to ignorance of bodies, future mind, is just temporarily washed. I think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering.
Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.